Education Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Tuesday, July 8th, and we are in an information session on House Bill 5028, which is the capital construction bill for the Department of Higher Education. Mr. Bender, could you take us through the information that you've given the committee today?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, and good morning. Today you have on your schedule a work session on House Bill 5028, which is the higher ed capital construction bill. And then following that, a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 155, which is relating to the State Board of Psychologist Examiners Licensing Authority. To start off with, though, I'd like to just remind you that you did have a work session last Thursday on 5028, at which time you considered and approved a number of capital projects for higher education. What they all had in common, they were quite different from each other, but what they all had in common is that none of those projects imposed any debt service costs on the state's general fund in the future. What you started off hearing about at the end of the meeting on Thursday, and you will continue to hear more information from the department today, are a set of proposed additional projects that would impose debt service requirements on the state budget in the future, either in the form of lottery bonds that would be paid back by future lottery earnings, or Article 11G bonds, which would be repaid by the state's general fund in the future. I thought it might be helpful just to put all of these projects sort of on one page, so as you hear these discussions, you can see the numbers associated with them. And that is this table, which I've distributed to you this morning, which has Department of Higher Education proposed lottery bond projects. These projects fall into two broad categories. The first are the proposals of the Engineering and Technology Industry Council, or ETEC as it's commonly called, for lottery bond financed projects. If you look at all of those projects in number one there, or in section one, you'll see that none of these have any Article 11G bonds in them. These are all lottery bond projects. They total $17.9 million in lottery bonds to the Department of Higher Education for capital construction projects. I would note that there is an additional $2.1 million that the governor is proposing in lottery bonds for the ETEC proposals. That would be for the Oregon Health Sciences University's OGI campus, and because OHSU is not a component of the Oregon University system, if you approve that, that would not go in 5028. It would just be these projects here and the $17.9 million that would go into House Bill 5028. And you can see there are lottery bonds. The other revenues are donations, grant funds, other institutional revenues of $17.2 million. For a little over $35 million in projects here at the Oregon University system. And you can see the amounts vary by campus there. And there is more description. We received more detailed description as to what the funds would be used for on each of these seven campuses. And we can go through some of that some more if you'd like, or ask the system to give you more information. Before we do that, I'd like to ask you if you could please flip over to the back side of the page that you were just looking at. And you can see on the back of this page, there's a bit more detail here on the lottery-funded projects by campus. This sums up to the $20 million. This was something that OUS provided in their handouts to you on Thursday, so I just made a copy of this page. This also includes the OGI as the second row there. That's why it sums up to the $20 million instead of the $17.9 million. But you can see that some of this is being used for new facilities, improvements to facilities, laboratory equipment, other capital investment. I wanted to point this out to you to note that LFO does have some concerns about the use of these lottery bonds for some of the laboratory equipment and other equipment, because the lottery bonds would be issued on a 15-year term, which means that debt service would be paid through the year, at least the year 2017. And to the extent that any of these proceeds are being used to purchase equipment that would have a much shorter useful life, we believe that that would not be a prudent use of lottery bonds. Looking over some of the material, for example, some of the funds are being planned to be used to purchase workstations and other types of computer equipment that we would not expect to still be used in 15 years. So people would, the legislature in 2017 would have to be providing debt service for equipment that hadn't been used for many years. And that would be of some concern to us. So we would ask, we would probably be looking into that further if you bring these back for work session for consideration. Flipping over to the front side of the page again, the other area that is being proposed to use lottery bonds to help finance for the Department of Higher Education is in the Signature Research Centers. It was the Signature Research Centers that you were receiving information on Thursday when you had to adjourn because of time, and which people are back here today. The deans are back from the engineering colleges are back here to talk further about the Signature Research Center proposals. As you can see, there are three campuses that would receive funds. Basically, it's $19 million each in total to OSU and to the University of Oregon, and $2 million to Portland State University for a $40 million total. Approximately half of this would be bonds. You can see at OSU, they're talking about $4.75 million in Article 11G bonds, $4.75 million in lottery bonds, and a match of $9.5 million in other revenues. That would be gifts, grants, and other institutional revenues available to OSU that could be used or diverted to these particular initiatives. Portland State's piece is $2 million, which is half bonded and half other revenues. And finally, the University of Oregon, there's a little bit of confusion here, I think. I think it's not clear whether the bonding amounts were supposed to be the same as for OSU or not, but in the materials that U of O submitted, they came together with a plan that had $9 million in bonding and $10 million in other revenues. So that's what we've shown here. Just to note some things about these proposals, you'll note that they use both Article 11G bonds and lottery bonds. The use of lottery bonds for higher education capital construction projects is something that the state has never done until the 2001 session. That was the first time that any lottery bonds were used at all for higher education capital construction projects. And the main reason why, I believe, those have not been used is that the Constitution of the state, which severely restricts and limits the ability of the state to issue bonds for capital construction projects, does have a provision, however, Article 11G, which allows these bonds to be issued for higher education facilities only. So therefore, one thing you may want to consider or question is the use of lottery bonds for these projects when Article 11G bond authority is already available and could be used in lieu of lottery bonds. You may ask, well, does it matter which of these two we use? One thing to note is that the lottery bonds traditionally are issued for, as I mentioned earlier, a 15-year term. The Article 11G bonds would most likely be issued for a 25 or 30-year term. And because they could be issued for a longer term, the debt service in each biennium would be less. You would, of course, end up paying more over the full life of the bond because it has a longer term, but the cost in each biennium would be lower. If we believe, or if these facilities that our investments are being made have a useful life of 30 years, there's no reason necessarily for the state to restrict itself to issuing bonds that only have a 15-year term. unless there's some other overwhelming advantage to doing that.
Mr. Bender, do the comments that you're making concerning lottery bonds as opposed to 11G bonds also apply to the ETIC projects?
Generally, these bonds, I do believe, could also be issued for the proposals that are before us for ETIC. Certainly for some of those, there's no doubt that they could be used for those purposes. In other cases, LFO would have the same concerns about issuing bonds for equipment that would have a very short useful life. But except for that, I don't see a situation where Article 11G bonds would not be available to fund the projects under the ETEC proposal either. The exception would be, well, I take that back. I was going to say the OGI piece might be an exception, but I would not. Let me defer to Legislative Council on that issue. I'm not sure.
Is there a historic precedent for using lottery bonds to fund ETEC-type projects?
Not for that. The only lottery bonds that the state has issued for higher ed, which again was in the 2001 session, were for a facility, an academic facility at Eastern Oregon University, and for a library expansion at Southern Oregon University.
Thank you.
Remember those situations?
Mm-hmm. Both.
Both of them.
Very well.
Mark.
Please proceed.
I have no further information. I will note to you that you've also had distributed, or we've distributed for you, 3 pages of information from the Oregon University system. These are the descriptions by the 3 campuses on their components of the Signature Research Centers. I was informed this morning that they do have some changes from what had been distributed to you on Thursday. I'm not aware of what those changes are, so I would hope that the department would indicate what's changed in their presentation.
Could we have the department come forward now? I think that you wish to make some clarification on the Signature Research Center, that the numbers that are on this spreadsheet. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Grattan Cairns from the Oregon University System.
And Bob Simonton, also from the Oregon University System.
Madam Chair, to my knowledge, this is an arithmetic error that crept in someplace. This was printed and proposed in Senate Bill 360 for the Signature Research proposals as a $40 million package, which would be 19, 19, and 2, with 9.5 going to OSU and 9.5 going to University of Oregon in bond proceeds and a matching amount in other funds, so that the University of Oregon line would match the Oregon State University line. So it's to my knowledge, it's an arithmetic error that crept in someplace, not found in the original bill. Anything more?
Is that the change in these materials?
The witnesses will come up there. I think they've got some, they've added some verbiage to the material which was published and which we had last Thursday to answer some of the questions that were raised, and they'll address them as they go through their testimony.
Okay. Then are there any questions or comments from the members of the committee? Thank you, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. Appreciate the clarification. And I will call Dean Adams and Dean Driscoll and Dean Linton. Good morning, gentlemen, and thank you for making the trek to Salem again.
Thanks for having us here again. And for the record, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ron Adams. I'm Dean of Engineering at Oregon State University. And we're back again to speak to the Multi-Scale Materials and Devices Signature Research Center proposal. And just for your jog your memory a little bit, as we discussed before, this is about an industry that's already indigenous to Oregon. The example of the Hewlett-Packard ink cartridges is a great example of technology that's inside of what we call multi-scale materials and devices. Also, as you heard before, this is a collaborative effort involving our three institutions as well as OHSU, OGI, and the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. As you know, that's operated by Battelle Memorial Institute. And the examples that we gave you before, not only the inkjet cartridge in terms of what's in the industry today, but also the future applications, including sensors that would detect threats to homeland security. You've already heard about the bonding proposal, which is ultimately a $40 million in capital projects at our institutions. And you also heard about how that would be divided amongst bonds versus other funds. Also, just to, again, remind you, on July 1st, we did sign a memorandum of understanding to collaborate together to make this a successful enterprise here in Oregon. The again, is that the MMD-related companies in Oregon, including Hewlett-Packard, as you heard, Xerox, Intel, FEI, ESI, and others are pulling together a collaborative that they are calling Micro to Nano, and that's a group that will help support our efforts to garner private and federal funds. You also heard about the potential economic impact, and that Senate Bill 360 includes a request for operating funds of $10 million. The business plan that has been presented to OCHED for this center includes $1 million per year in operating funds that will be required. So in the next session, we will be seeking $2 million in operating funds for the center. The project is expected to leverage greater than $400 million in private and federal funds within the next decade, and then also produce greater than 15 new companies in this technology area. And Oregon has an opportunity not only to create new companies, but also to potentially create a new industry that has a market address greater than $20 billion per year. The OSU project is to create what we call the Microproducts Breakthrough Institute. This is a location of a collaboration with the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, and its purpose will be to develop the integration of nanotechnology into microscale devices and also to move those towards the market. And you heard that our project is a $19 million project, which includes $14.8 million to remodel Graff Hall into a 30,000-square-foot laboratory and $4.8 million in equipment to fabricate and test these devices. And a summary that you just heard from Mr. Bender is that this would be $9.5 million in bonding with that split between 11G and lottery bonds. Now, many of you saw the news again a few weeks ago that Hewlett-Packard has donated the use of one of their buildings, which is designated Building 11, as a temporary home for the Microproducts Breakthrough Institute, which is now part of this MMD Signature Research Center. The value of that donation is about $2 million, and that'll be the temporary home until we complete the renovation of Graff Hall. So the things that are new for you today are, one is that we are being clear about what the operating costs will be in future biennia. And the second is, I don't believe the last time around you heard the value of the donation from Hewlett-Packard.
The Dean Adams, so per biennium, you will require $2 million to be put into the facility at Oregon State from the general fund or some kind of resource.
No, I'm sorry, I misled you. The $2 million is the total operating expense to run the Collaborative Signature Research Center.
Okay. $2 million covers the needs of the research center. And then I'm assuming that there'll be... what is this? Does this fund positions or does this fund services and supplies? What are we talking about here? What are you going to be using the money for?
The funds will be used for administrative expenses of running the center, to cover services and supplies for that, as well as personnel, basically to run the collaborative center, which includes our three campuses plus the Oregon Graduate Institute.
So this will have a roll-up factor attached to it because it'll have salaries and inflation on services and supplies.
Correct.
Okay. Further questions?
Madam Chair, just following up on that. Okay.
Follow up?
These will be state employees.
I'm sorry?
The $2 million will be for new state employees?
Correct.
How many FTE do you expect to have there?
This would cover the cost of a director plus administrative help, and I would say roughly we're speaking about 4 to 5 people, and then plus operating expenses on top of that.
So 5 people would net out at about
$600,000. It's for 2 years.
Uh-huh. So there's an awful lot of other expenses that you're covering there, too.
Does that include
Representative Bates, did you have another follow-up?
I'm just formulating it in my mind, Madam
okay.
Chair.
Okay. Representative Smith.
Well, does that include rent? Because your bottom says... with $2 million lease value, your temporary home, would that include your lease payment or your building or whatever?
We expect to exit that facility in 3 years, and the $2 million is the value of the donation of the use of the facility.
Oh, I see. Okay. So you're not paying lease?
No.
So in this $2 million per biennium, it's not the cost of actually... occupying the building.
Correct.
Okay.
Now we can, if you need to see the detail about how the operating funds will be used, we can bring that back to you.
I think that would be very helpful to
okay.
us if we could have that detail.
Okay.
Representative Marsh?
Thank you. I think the MMD business plan would kind of help us get a handle around that and what the you're talking about a $2 million per biennium operating cost. What's the $10 million operating cost by this biennium? That's the other question.
Yes, and the business plan does detail that, and we will also provide that to you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
What's in Building 11 right now?
Building 11 is predominantly empty, and it is originally was a service center for Hewlett-Packard. And because of the way they've changed the way they do business now, so that they don't need that space.
Is that part of the that part of the movement of people from Corvallis down to other states? I know there was an outflow of personnel recently.
Oh, I can't. I don't know the answer to that question. It's difficult for me to speak for Hewlett-Packard on that.
Well, in fact, you're speaking for Hewlett-Packard today. We put up a lot of money from the state to support a program. And they're part of the consortium. I just wonder I don't understand, I guess. You've got a building already that's good for 3 years. Why it's not good for 15 years? What's the cost of that building? Why do you want to redo something? This is a lot of questions in my mind. It's a lot of money. And it's sort of coming to the end of session. I've looked at it carefully. Others may have a better feeling about this than I do. I think it's appropriate to have a public-private partnership for high tech. I agree with that. But this is a single piece of paper here for a lot of money.
The gift that we have from Hewlett-Packard does have a time limit on it. The second thing is that the best case for the operation of the MMD is to have the laboratory located on campus next near where the faculty are. So during this interim period, there will be some level of hardship on the part of the people involved because of the distance.
So there will be an ongoing issue here after 3 years pass where this is going to end up being cited, I would assume.
It's in Grand Falls. You got the site for it already.
Chair Morgan, we do have the site is a building on OSU campus that we will remodel to create the laboratory space.
Thank you. Have you completed your testimony?
Yes, I am.
Representative Messerly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That does beg a question. we're going for a extended bond on and remodeling an older building, what do you expect the life of that older building to be after you remodel it?
The Senator Messerly, I believe the life will be at least 30 to 50 years of once it's remodeled. As you know, the buildings on our campuses are quite old, and we've been able to successfully extend their lives in the past by remodeling.
Thank you.
Mr. Bender, do we have any information about what would be incurred in terms of indebtedness to the general fund if we were to switch all this over to 11G bonds? And what would be incurred to the lottery revenue stream if we were to use lottery bonds in the bienniums?
Yes, Madam Chair, I do have some information on that. And
what was your question, Representative Morgan?
I'm just curious about if we were to commit the state to fund all of this, mm-hmm. either Article 11G bonds,
right.
or to go ahead with the program as it's laid out here,
oh,
with part of it being 11G and part of it being lottery bonds,
uh-huh.
what we will be indebting the general fund and the lottery funding stream to uh-huh. in future years in terms of payback.
Now, is that because of the different length of term, you're wondering?
Well, I'm just...
Because the 15-year on lottery...
If this project goes ahead, every time the legislature meets, there's
right.
going to be a piece of the general fund mm-hmm. and a piece of the lottery revenue
mm-hmm.
that's going to have to go to pay this back. I want to know what that looks like.
Right.
Under the proposal, as it's submitted to you by the governor, for the we're only talking about the $20 million now for the signature research centers, with $10 million in Article 11G bonds and $10 million in lottery bonds. The projected debt service would be about $3.25 million per biennium.
For how long?
Well, for through 2018, that would be the debt service, would be about $3.25 million. Then after 2018, the lottery bonds will have been retired, and the Article 11G bonds would still have 15 years remaining. And at that point, the debt service, remaining debt service, would be about $1.22 million through 2033. So there would be a debt service stream immediately of $3.25 million, down to about 1.22. If the debt service, if the lottery, if the project were entirely financed by Article 11G bonds, instead of it being 1.2 million per biennium, which is what you have left when that's all you're paying, you would have to, it would be 2.4 million in total, because you would have the full $20 million in Article 11G bonds. So what that means is that next biennium, if this were entirely Article 11G bond financed, the debt service would be $2.4 million. If it's as proposed in the governor's budget, it would be $3.25 million. So you have about an $840,000 roughly reduction in debt service by issuing it entirely as G bonds instead of split between G and lottery. Over the course of the term of the bonds, however, if you do this entirely by Article 11G, it will cost you an extra $3.33 million over the 30-year term. But in each particular biennium through 2018, you will get less debt service than you do under the governor's proposal.
I don't understand why it'll cost $3.some million more over the long term.
The reason why is you'll be paying all of the $20 million off over 30 years, whereas under the governor's proposal, 10 of the $20 million is going to be paid off after 15 years, and that saves you something.
So it's interest.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Senator Messerly.
Madam Chair, maybe I missed it, but I didn't hear a response as to the concern of Mr. Bender of using long-term debt to buy equipment. Yes. Do the department heads have a, the deans have a response to that?
Would you like to address that issue?
What was
any
the?
Of you? I don't want to be have Dean Adams be in the spotlight here.
I can take a first crack at that, too. Rich Linton, Vice President for Research and Dean of the Graduate School at the University of Oregon. Indeed, some of the bonding would be used to match equipment funding, particularly from the federal government, in terms of most of our campus interests, I think. Much of that would be in the major equipment category, which would be depreciated over time, but I think in our case, the lottery bonds obviously would be much more attractive in the 15-year time frame as opposed to a G-bond 30-year time frame. I can't speak for the others exactly, but in terms of our plan, it certainly would be for major equipment match to federal grants like NSF, National Institutes of Health, and equipment with a relatively long lifetime.
Do we have, Mr. Bender, somewhere the detail on the equipment purchases to get a kind of a bead on how much of it is short-term and how much of it is longer-term?
We don't have complete information, though. We do have some descriptions that were distributed to you on Thursday. I don't know if I can make some copies, but some of these, some of the descriptions, which were on a campus-by-campus basis, do include descriptions of computer workstations, for example, though there aren't specific dollar amounts tied to any of the various components in the descriptions that we've received. I wouldn't say to any of them, but to a number of them.
Would it be possible to get a breakout with detail on exactly what you're proposing to do with the other equipment part of this budget?
Yeah, we had provided earlier through OUS some detailed outlines of the specifics of the equipment that would be part of the package. So that is already available, but not in your summaries.
Chair Morgan, Bob Simonton again from Oregon University System. Using bond funds to purchase equipment, we're guided by our bond council, but also want to add that part of the funding package for this signature research is gift funds. So we would predominantly use gift funds to purchase the equipment. So we can restructure Mr. Bender's table here and shift some of the equipment purchases to use gift funds.
What then would you use the bond proceeds for if they were not needed for the what they had been?
The bond funds would predominantly be used for bricks and mortar kind of facilities. This table, too, is showing strictly the use of the lottery bonds and does not reflect the use of the 18 or so million of gift funds.
Just to make sure it's clear, that table being referred to as the ETIC package, not the signature research.
I think you've gotten us all confused at this point. Representative.
Just a couple of comments. Steve, maybe you can help me with this, too. No answer right now. Considering that we are in an exceptionally good time to float bonds because of low interest rates, and because we can commonly get those bonds at a lower rate, potentially at 15 than 30 years, I'm a little concerned about tying up the state for 30 years on this project. A lot of this is a research project, and it's hard for me to believe that in 30 years we'll be using those facilities exactly the way we're starting out now. If you looked at the possibility of a shorter bond issue and a lower interest rate that would possibly allow us to not spend quite so much money to do this, and I assume some of the changes that Graff Hall aren't just for redesigning it as a research center, but would be substantial, that structure, so that it would be improved for a long period of time. Air conditioning, heating, basic structural changes, so you could redesign the interior of it in 15 years if things change. I mean, technology is moving so quickly, it's hard for me to believe you can build a laboratory you expect to use 30 years from now for what you envision right now. But 15 years seems like a reasonable time to me. Could you look at the possibility of a shorter 11G? Are we allowed to issue a shorter 11G? I mean, and take advantage of potentially a lower interest rate?
That would be something that we could check with.
Revenue?
Gas.
Gas?
And their bond, their capital construction section.
Can we tighten this thing up a little bit? I'm sorry. This thing was so difficult. I really wish we had time to actually go to the site and look at this thing and get an idea of what's really happening and give you the time you really deserve to show us what this is. And it's an exciting project, but I don't have much knowledge on it. And we're being asked to vote on something that's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish we could go down and look at it, understand it better, and support you more.
Probably have time.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My questions are about the Signature Research Center and the economic development impact, wanting to better understand some assumptions behind numbers you have here on the page. In 7 years, we will see 15 new companies. In 7 years, we will see 2,000 new jobs. Do you have supporting documentation that describes the assumptions behind these, I'm calling them projections, so that we might better understand how you arrived at these numbers?
Senator Gordley, some of the information you're asking about is also in our business plan. And in that plan, we have examples of companies that have already begun the process of spinning out of the center. In addition to that, there are some metrics that have been established nationally relating the impact of investments in R&D and universities and on the development of new companies. And perhaps you could...
Yeah, a couple of the benchmarks. One, for example, is that in general, for $100 million in research and development funding, typically at major institutions, approximately one startup company is created. So when we're looking over a seven-year period at hundreds of millions of dollars of investments in research and development, you'd expect, if you were an average activity nationally, you'd create 3 to 5 companies. But this is an area that's, remember, the signature research concept is targeting the translation of the basic innovation and research into commercial products. So our metrics are more aggressive than this average national picture. And so I think it's very realistic to think about startup company creation at the level that we've proposed, that is on the order of 15 by the year 2010, if in fact the funding is provided, if seed investments are provided now and that we can leverage those in the next years. I think it's very realistic. I think all the institutions are being much more active now in the creation of new companies. Oregon State, I think, has announced a number already or about to related to the microproducts breakthrough initiatives. University of Oregon typically is creating 2 companies per $100 million already, which puts us in the top 25 of all universities nationally in translating basic research funding into startup companies. So I think even though that number looks large and aggressive, I think it's very realistic.
Well, just an added remark to what you just heard. Is that, as you heard, OSU has a company that's in the process of spinning out, and that's as a result of approximately $5 million in R&D investment. And that company, by the way, will address the need for sensors for biological hazards. There's also a second investment that's underway of $6 million in which the Department of Defense has also expressed an interest in OSU spinning a company out to develop a system to cool a infantry person while wearing a hazardous substance protection suit. And we're expecting, so as a result of less than $15 million in investment, we're looking at potentially 2 companies already. Again, to support the remarks that you heard from Dr. Linton about the national averages versus what's happening here.
And just to add to that, Chair Morgan, Senator Gordley, for the record, I'm Mike Driscoll, Vice Provost at Portland State. PSU has an incubator space in one location on campus already, housing a startup company that's there for the intellectual property being generated at Portland State by our faculty today. is in negotiation with another company that would directly benefit from the work of the Signature Research Center. And since I put my testimony on the page, in fact, is in very initial stages of discussions with a third potential startup that would make use of this particular Signature Research Center.
And so if I may follow up, Madam Chair, can it be said then that you have absolute confidence that these accomplishments will be realized in 7 years?
I think absolute confidence may be a little strong because it's, you know, a long-term time frame and there are risks obviously involved and competition internationally in these areas, but I think it's a realistic plan. I think we'll make great progress toward those goals.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
One other comment, Senator Gordley, you were talking about job creation and 2,000 jobs supported out of the initiative. I think the best benchmark there that we work from in the universities is that when we receive $1 million of research and development support, the U.S. Department of Commerce tells us that that supports in the broader economy 47 jobs. And so when we're looking at this time frame, hundreds of millions of dollars of funding, primarily, again, from the federal government leveraging the state seed investment, you can do the math. A few hundred million in federal support for R&D over a decade would translate into, you know, thousands of jobs being supported directly. That does not include the tech transfer, the startup companies, the employment of people that come out of the tech transfer process. That's the direct support of jobs in the economy from the research funding that the universities get. So I think that number, if you put it in that context, again, is very realistic.
Madam Chair,
Senator Gordley,
I think, you know, what we're dealing with here are projections, you know, based on assumptions, all reflected in your business plan. And what I'm picking up on here is the way in which these projections are couched. In your economic development impact statement, you say that you will deliver the following results. And so, again, I'm just trying to nail that piece down. I think the best we can say is that we'll see.
I think we could all comment on that. I think it's much stronger than we'll see.
Okay.
I think we have put down numbers that, again, I feel are very representative of where we think we'll be in 2010. But, you know, frankly, the legislature in 1996 would have had a real hard time projecting where the state economy would be in 2003. So I think, to be fair, you have to say that this international competition and high technology and development is, you know, difficult to project out. But we think these numbers are realistic, and even if we didn't create $300 million of federal support, if we created $200 million in additional federal support, I think we would be tremendously benefited as a state. But I think we did our best in the business plan to give you an idea where we think we'll be in 2010, the best idea of where we'll be. And even if we fall somewhat short of that, I think it would be a tremendous benefit to the state. So I wouldn't look at it as just black and white. Here we are today, in 10 years, this is exactly where we'll be. It would be unrealistic to say that, irresponsible to say that. But, you know, I think we have great confidence this is going to be a tremendously successful project. Maybe our colleagues would want to add.
Yeah, I'd just add to Dr. Linton's remarks. I would characterize this as a realistic plan, and it does require investment. And what we're presenting to you is what we think is a realistic return on that investment.
Representative March, you were wanting to ask some questions.
I actually, one question I had of Mr. Bender was Article 11G bonds can be paid back with an ad valorem or property tax. Has the state ever done that?
The state has not done that. Those are, because these are general obligation bonds, that language in the Constitution clarifies that the state would use a statewide property tax if necessary to pay debt service. But we have always used general fund for that.
It doesn't say if necessary, but it says it may be paid back with other funds. So to follow up on that question then, could other funds other than general fund be used to pay back 11G?
Yes. As long as the state is obligated to pay that debt service, we do use general fund for that purpose. But if you if the legislature were to identify another source of repayment, I assume that those bonds could be sold under that street level.
Thank you.
Mr. Linton, I think we have seriously derailed your presence.
That's okay.
So let's
appreciate the discussion. I think if you refer to the written testimony, again, that would highlight the key points regarding the University of Oregon contribution. I'm not going to go back and reiterate some of the more general comments. I think one issue, of course, is that the University of Oregon is a leader in the nanoscience area, which feeds into the initiative. In fact, the Register Guard yesterday had a very nice piece on our nanotech work entitled UO Puts Big Hopes in Tiny Technology, and that would give you a nice up-to-date summary of some of the work that we're doing. In terms of the MMD specifically, we would be really contributing two major things to the initiative in addition to the more general areas of job creation, startup company creation, collaborative work with industry. Specifically, we would have instrumentation and facilities to help manufacture or create materials with control at the nanometer scale, the single atom, small molecule scale of making materials. And then secondly, when you make those things, you have to understand how they work, the physics and chemistry, the structural properties, etc. And we would then have world-class facilities to measure those properties. So what we're talking about really is a high-tech extension service idea where we would create facilities both to make small materials and devices as well as to characterize their performance. So the funding that we're requesting, if you actually flip to the backside of this testimony, it gives you a very concise summary. We would be creating this MMD laboratory to house this combined facility for making and characterizing materials in the broader integrative science complex, which is related to our overall science facilities, interdisciplinary science facilities at the University of Oregon. So we've been very specific about how it would relate to facilities versus equipment. About $13 million of the request would go to the facility. And in the second bullet point there, $5 million would go towards the equipment to fabricate and test the nanoscale materials. And again, as I had said earlier, that funding would be coming in part from the federal government, in part from industry collaborators, and in part, in principle, could use some bonding for major equipment with a long lifetime. But again, we would have some latitude in where that match came from. If the bonding was not a particularly good vehicle for that particular component, then we would use private gifts, institutional funds, major competitive grants that would allow us to match that. We have all along been saying in the next bullet point exactly the same financial plan as Oregon State. So there's no correction in our arithmetic as far as the division between the lottery bonds and the G bonds and the match. It's $4.75 million in G bonds, the equivalent amount in lottery, and then the total of $9.5 million in match. So it's identical to the Oregon State line and should be corrected in the spreadsheet presentation that you have seen earlier. We also have a plan to get things up and running quickly at the University of Oregon. We, of course, already have our Material Science Institute. We have established programs ongoing. But to create the MMD lab, short-term, we would use interim facilities and available space in our Riverfront Research Park. So that would very much parallel what's happening at Oregon State with the HP donation. It allows us in the short-term to create some facilities, renovating them at modest costs, housing major new equipment facilities to begin more aggressive work toward the objectives of MMD. Without those interim facilities, we would obviously be further behind the curve in meeting those seven-year objectives, and also further behind in terms of meeting international competition related to these areas. So I think having an interim plan in place at both campuses makes excellent sense, even though in the end, you know, you're spending a little bit of money on renovation for temporary space, but I think that's a reasonable approach to getting things moving by 2004, and also to leverage commitments of companies like HP at Oregon State. So finally, I think you've heard some of the economic impact. We have the more detailed business plan. We've alluded to some of the metrics behind that initiative.
If I could interrupt, Representative Smith has a question. I don't think we've touched on this. Who else is doing what you're going to attempt to be doing?
That's really an excellent question. The area of nanoscience and nanotechnology, of course, is one that's been broadly worked on nationally. A number of organizations involved, federal efforts to put more funding into it. The niche that we're talking about here really, though, is the integration between nanoscale work, which has been to date primarily in the very basic research domain, and micro-scale microengineering work, which is the practical platform on which those new discoveries will rest. So it's this integration between the basic physics and chemistry of materials and the engineering to allow them to be made into a practical functioning device. That's the true niche for this initiative. We can find a few places in the country that also talk about multi-scale integration. There are two national laboratories working on it. But in large measure, it's the future of this technology is the integration. And I think collectively, with the resources that we have, we can, you know, be out front in that. Even though, again, you're seeing lots of publicity about nanoscience and nanoscale work nationally, but the multi-scale piece is quite a different initiative in terms of bringing together engineering and basic physics and chemistry in a way that few other places currently are doing.
So, Representative Smith, I'd add to that that combination of Oregon State and Pacific Northwest National Labs are the national leader in microscale devices. If you look for someone else that's working in this area, you'll find MIT. And then beyond that, there are a few, I'll say, small single investigator projects spread around other universities. PNNL and OSU collaboration does represent the national leadership there. And so the opportunity we have is to put together some very strong players and in a complementary way that achieves a much stronger position than many other schools and universities would have.
When the federal government issues funding for research projects, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, they may be funding, saying, yeah, we'll fund Oregon's nano research, so at the same time going to fund MIT's nano research or XYZ's nano research. Is that true?
Absolutely.
And then the race is on, so to speak, so you can get there first.
Yeah, just like in any area of science and technology and engineering.
So you're not the only federal funding source for nano research that the federal government would be interested in.
Correct. I mean, Senator Wyden, for example, is leading the effort with Senate Bill 189 at the federal level, which would provide a little over $1 billion in new funding for initiatives. We have been successful on the House side with efforts, for example, from Representative Wu in the House to get language into their counterpart bill that better reflects the initiatives, the unique strengths that Oregon has. So they've built into that legislation some wording about multi-scale integration and new research centers, multidisciplinary. So, you know, we think we've got a more of a leg up in terms of what may come out at the federal level in support of our initiatives here. But much of that funding will be a competitive grants mechanism. Collectively, we're already attracting, I guess, between Oregon State, U of O, and PSU, over $20 million a year in competitive grants that relate to the engineering areas, materials areas that have the foundation of what we're talking about with the MMD. So a large measure of what we're doing is really based on meeting the test nationally, having peer-reviewed proposals that are awarded funding because of their merit and their quality.
Thank you. Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you actually develop some new materials or new devices, those are probably in some way licensed and become proprietary for a company. Is there any payback to the universities for developing those products?
Yeah, there would be. Our typical arrangements when we start up a company, for example, the university can hold equity in that company, particularly with the help of ballot measure 10 that was passed last year. So there's more flexibility to own equity stakes in new companies. Typically, when we're out licensing now, for example, at the University of Oregon, roughly one-third of the revenue goes back to the inventors, one-third to the programs, departments, centers that created it, supported it, and one-third typically goes centrally to the institution. In University of Oregon's case, that goes to my office, and rather than my using it more generally to serve research purposes at the institution, I'm committed to plowing that back into economic development, technology transfer, so that money goes back directly in supporting programs that have more of a direct line of sight to commercialization, to create companies, to create other commercial products. So there's a sharing of that revenue. The things we're talking about here, I think, would work similarly. We also are looking at innovative structures to help facilitate the commercialization of technologies through a development corporation, a non-profit organization that might help us be more effective in that area. So that is also talked about in the MMD business plan.
Are you going to ask the obvious follow-up question?
Maybe it's not obvious when you're looking at. Is there, in your business plan, do you look at this as something that in 7 to 10 years could be partially or totally self-funded?
Well, I think overall the business plan is really one that is largely self-funded. If you're talking about non-state appropriated dollars, the plan is basically, like most of our research activities, they are successful in bringing in funds that sustain the program from the outside. So, for example, at the University of Oregon, we have now about $75 million in external grants competitively awarded for research on a 600-some-odd faculty base. So, you know, each faculty member on average is bringing in more than $100,000 per year in new competitive grants from non-state funding. There's a line item in our state appropriation for research at the University of Oregon. That's $1.2 million. It took a 20% hit in the third special session of the legislature last year across the U.S. So we're down to a very minimal percent of our research budget already being funded by the state. I mean, the major state commitment is to facilities and the faculty lines. And as I just said, the faculty, you know, when you hire one, on average at the U of O, they're bringing in more funding from non-state sources than what the state might provide in the way of salary and benefits for that position. So it's a great state investment and a great payback to Oregon for these types of seed investments. So, frankly, we don't expect the state to be the major supporter of research. We are disappointed that it's such a small percentage of our effort currently, but in any case, it's largely self-sustaining from non-state funding generally in research, and this area would be no different. In fact, would probably even have a greater percentage of non-state funding relative to the total effort.
Representative Bates, so just to add to what you just heard, over the long term, at least a partial source of money to support those operating expenses that we discussed earlier is the revenue that comes back from the licensing of technology.
Well, we look at a lot bigger budget than this, and the state, as most states are now, are really in a difficult situation when we don't see any way out of the next 5 or 10 years on a significant basis. And so when we're asked to make this kind of investment, like any prudent business investment that would be made, we'd expect to return that investment. Return of investment is a little nebulous because, of course, it goes to the whole state, creates jobs, and those jobs ultimately will produce, frankly, taxes, and we'll receive that back. It's hard to track all that. Some baseball players have tried that. It's very difficult to follow sometimes. it's the same principle. My question really is a little more specific, and that is you are going to be producing, hopefully, some very exceptional materials and devices which have commercial value. And I would hope that the direct payback to you on those, as we are now looking at the issues as far as universities receiving monies back on their research, would help sustain these kind of programs, potentially build more capital for you to reinvest and expand your programs without having to come to us, which is difficult for us because of our difficulty in our general revenues. So I would like to hear more about that and see that as part of your business plan, that this would be self-sustaining somewhere along the line.
If I might interject to a little subset to your question that interests me is, we hear you talking to us about the ability of the things that will be developed through your research to generate money for the institutions and for the people that develop the concepts. And I'm wondering if anywhere in your discussions of the signature research centers, if you looked at the possibility of essentially self-funding them through those kinds of entrepreneurial activities and through that money that would be coming back into the centers.
Yeah, I think that really, as Ron was alluding to, that's part of the plan, but to give you a metric to put this in a little more perspective, typically for every dollar that's invested in research and development, about 1 cent comes back in terms of licensing revenue to the institution. Again, that's an average across major research universities nationally. So if we're talking about a $100 million investment, let's say, then we would expect just $1 million in licensing revenues if we were doing an average job. Again, the metrics here are a little bit more aggressive. We're talking about within 7 years several $1 million worth of licensing revenues, tech transfer revenues coming back in. But still, when we're talking about the magnitude overall of the effort, the core funding really is the federal funding and some industry collaboration. And the tech transfer element, although important, realistically, you know, that alone is not going to make this a self-supporting effort in the next 7 years, but it'll be a significant contributor. The key element will be the federal and industry support for the initiative. But clearly, we're talking about a seed investment that the state would provide, mainly for capital, a little bit of ongoing operating for the core operations of this statewide effort. And that's where the self-sustaining part is, in my view. It's not just, it can't be self-sustained completely unless we hit a home run, which we very well may, or maybe several home runs during this next 5 to 7 years. But our plan is not based around assuming that that's going to happen. It's developing a lot of new small startup companies, enhancing the work our major companies in the state do. And again, I think we have a very realistic plan, but let's not think that it's going to produce so much revenue that it will provide, you know, tens or hundreds of millions of dollars back for the initiative just from the tech transfer licensing side. I think our plan is much more realistic in that regard.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. I've got a rather loaded question, and the severity of my question will give you an idea of how we feel we're on the hot seat in funding any request that comes before our committees. If this technology fails and none of what you say happens, would your careers as researchers and doctors be toast? I mean, are you willing to put your own careers on the line?
I'm relatively new in Oregon, so I guess I put my career on the line to come here 3 years ago, and I haven't regretted it for 1 second. Came from North Carolina in the Research Triangle, saw the opportunities and the challenges here. So I think in a way I was putting my career on the line to work, in the area of research and development in a state that, you know, is very challenged right now economically. But I think we're making great strides. There is no way, I can clearly state, there is no way that this initiative would not provide tangible, measurable successes in the next years.
But like Ron Adams.
And we're not inventing this from ground zero. You know, we're building on strengths that you, like through the ETIC funding earlier, you have created opportunities for the institutions and industry in the state. We're just trying to take advantage of those opportunities. You know, if MMD is funded at a lesser level, we will still have significant successes to point to and further elaboration of the success of engineering at Oregon State, the sciences at the U of O, engineering emphases at Portland State. All those areas will definitely grow, develop, have higher quality. So, sure, I'll put my job on the line because I'm absolutely confident.
Well, it is getting to be almost 10 o'clock, and
okay,
it's my intention to also do a work session on Senate Bill 155, and I'd like to be done with the information session on 5028 in about 15 minutes. So if no one has any burning questions, I would like to give Mr. Driscoll a chance to talk.
Thank you, Chair Morgan. I will answer the question as well from Representative Smith. I think that a great deal of thought and careful review has gone into the development of the business plan, both within our respective institutions, with our industry colleagues, with our legislative delegation in Washington, D.C., to identify a place where we can find a niche. The time is right to become competitive for the state of Oregon in this area. And so I'm very comfortable with expressing a great deal of confidence in the payoff. Nothing is a sure bet, as we know. This is an investment, and investments fail. But this is, in fact, a place where all of us, with our careers, our backgrounds, have spent a great deal of time and careful thought with our colleagues, inside institutions, outside institutions. This is one of those places where the time seems to be right in all of our best judgments. And I don't think I'm stepping out of line from my colleagues here. If I may briefly talk about the specifics of the PSU component of the Signature Research Center, and I'll try to weave in a couple of comments that aren't in my written testimony, reflecting some of the very thoughtful questions that you have raised for us this morning, and I very much appreciate those. The changes from the material you received on Thursday here are just a couple of minor date corrections in terms of what's written on the page. PSU has already completed phase one of its Center for Nanoscience and Nanotechnology, and what we're asking for is funding to help take that facility to phase two. The center provides state-of-the-art electron microscopes that provide capabilities for looking at these very small structures that aren't otherwise available in Oregon universities. We are in the process of making these capabilities available statewide via the Internet, and that's some great work that we're doing together. The center faculty are, in fact, recognized leaders in fabricating new nanodevices, and we've heard some mention of Senator Wyden's 21st Century Nanotechnology Research and Development Act. One of our faculty members involved in the project was in D.C. in May, provided key testimony to the Senate Commerce Committee considering that. And I would also mention, in recognition of Representative Smith's question, that Representative Wu mentioned PSU's Center for Nanoscience and Nanotechnology in the congressional record discussing the House side of this legislation as a key example for the nation in this area. That's not a quote. We can get that for you if you'd like it. So it is a competitive system of funding, but in fact we are positioned fairly well to be competitive in this area. Just a rough number, that 21st Century Nanotechnology Research and Development Act is talking about an initial investment of somewhere in the neighborhood of $600 million at the federal level in several key areas. I would just emphasize what my colleagues have mentioned, and that is that the outcome of the work of the Signature Research Center in multi-scale materials and devices will result in new products that will have a great impact on how we live our lives, will help us treat diseases in new ways. I've been trying to tell my doctor about that in terms of my cholesterol problem, but he hasn't believed me just yet. It will help us keep our environment clean in new ways that have a less significant impact in a negative sense than some of our current technologies, and will help us build new generations of tailor-made materials. The specific project that we're discussing here at PSU is to expand the Center for Nanoscience and Nanotechnology from about 1,500 square feet today to about 5,000 square feet. This would add an advanced microscopy data analysis facility. It would include incubator space for new companies. I've mentioned that already briefly. And some new and enhanced equipment. The project that we're requesting here is asking for $1 million in bonds plus $1 million in other funds. And as has been mentioned, that funding at PSU as well would be from private and federal sources. And I do strongly believe that we would see those funds primarily going to the equipment side of this, whereas the bonding would provide some of the base infrastructure in terms of facilities renovation and so forth, recognizing Mr. Bender's important comment about the use of bonding and the lifetime of facilities. I think my colleagues have spoken quite well to the economic development impact. I will just mention that the startup that's at PSU today, Octavian, we have an arrangement with them in terms of holding some equity in that corporation in return for intellectual property developed at PSU. So there is that opportunity. Again, I share the caution that not all of these investments pay off in the first day. You need a portfolio. But this will happen in one of these cases, I think. Let me say at least one of these cases. That's important. I also want to share a personal comment. I've been in the Oregon University system for 15 years. The three of us and others have worked on this project and others together in the past. I just want to say that our mantra, if you will, in this is how do we make Oregon more competitive nationally and internationally in an area that we feel is one of the keys in a next step in economic development in science and technology. In recognition of Senator Gordley's valid concerns about can you guarantee what the business plan process, I think I can strongly guarantee that if we don't invest soon, now, in this technology, the train will leave the station and Oregon will be left behind. Whereas if we invest now, we are positioned to be very, very competitive together as a state to bring this new technology, the new science to fruition and to develop the kinds of economic benefits that my colleagues have spoken of today. So in the interest of time, let me finish my testimony there and open to questions as you may have them.
I don't know which one of you want to answer this, but I am curious about how the funding package ended up being split between 11G and lottery bonds and why you didn't choose to go in one direction or the other. Can you talk to us about that?
I think, yeah, maybe.
Mr. McGee.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, Bill McGee from the Department of Administrative Services. This was a proposal that was put together as part of the governor's revised budget, and I believe the package looked at where the appropriate use of lottery bonds for economic development was and attempted to make really a combination of different types of funding sources, looking at the maturation of the bonds as well. So it was a kind of a combined proposal that just developed out of the governor's process during session.
Did you have any discussion around Article 11G bonds that had a different date of maturity?
Madam Chair, I don't believe we actually talked about a shorter period of time for the G bonds, realizing, of course, that would increase the debt service in the initial biennium. So I think we're looking both at kind of the long-term costs and then what was appeared to be affordable in 2003-2005 as well.
Did you also have any discussion around the type of equipment that was being proposed for purchase under the lottery bonds?
Madam Chair, when the proposal, again, splitting the difference between the signature research and the ETIC, and Mr. Bender was really talking about the ETIC piece, I believe, table he referred to was, the governor had requested the system to come back with a $20 million capital proposal, and we did ask them to find items that were capitalizable. The timing of getting that through the system didn't give us a chance to go through a second round again with them doing that. I think they addressed the ability to maybe mix and match some of the pieces with the matching dollars. But again, we understand Mr. Bender's concerns there.
Thank you. Senator Gordon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McGee, that process of consultation in describing or defining which way to go with the bonding, does that process include, in this case, did that include the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department also looking at this proposal?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordon, they were involved in these conversations at the time as well.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Bates.
Mr. McGee, just real quickly, I'm very much in favor of this project. I think it's the kind of thing that the state and private parties should do together, but I just have a couple of questions. One, was there a discussion of maintaining ownership in at the university level of universities with these startup companies? I mean, that's where I think the real payback financially comes in, is not in licensing, but having significant ownership in those companies themselves. And because of the nature of these products being such high tech, I'm really interested in squeezing that window down on these bonds to 15 years, getting a lower interest rate, and going forward with the project. So, Steve, I think you're going to look at that for us. But was there a strong discussion about significant ownership of these companies? Many of them will obviously fail, but some of them might hit a home run. And I'd like to see the university, you know, get value for their investment, and the state get value through the university for that. Has that discussion occurred?
Madam Chair, I believe, Representative Bates, I believe that was part of the governor's interest in supporting this proposal, was to tie into that. I think the assumption was that there would be the retention of that interest, given the ballot measure 10 that passed last year.
I guess, Madam Chair, I feel more comfortable as more than just an assumption. I wanted, you know, we're going to own 25%, we're going to own 20%, we're going to own, you know, whatever. Whatever is a reasonable figure in the business for doing that, so that those companies understand we've nurtured you, we've incubated you, we've got you running, but we expect to be a part of any profits that might occur at a later time, and a substantial part.
Yeah, I can just add real quickly, Representative Bates. Typically, in an equity holding arrangement, spin-off startup coming out of the university, nationally about a 4% stake would be considered a reasonably high percentage. You know, the deals we've been doing recently have been as high as 9% of equity. I think we can all say, I think, confidently that as startups are created, typically we're looking at as one element being the ownership stake, and realistically, I think something in the 5, 6, 8% range of the equity is what the universities typically would expect. May sound small, but I think that's very representative of what's happening at the major research universities nationally, like MIT.
And I'll just add that matches our experience as well. That's the ballpark kind of number that is out there.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, again, for sharing your time and your expertise with us. We very much appreciate it.
Thank you. We appreciate your attention.
Chancellor Jarvis, could I call you forward for just one moment, please? When we last discussed the capital projects budget, I asked the university system to bring forward information about the funding stream from all funding streams that went into the engineering part of your budgets, and I haven't seen any information. I'm wondering what's going on.
Let me call Vice Chancellor Andrews, if I may.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we are working on that right now. It is a rather involved process in trying to identify the specifics of all the engineering dollars running through the cells. So we're going through that from all of the biennia that have been identified.
Do you have an ETA on that information?
I would hope that we could have something by next Tuesday, Monday or Tuesday.
Thank you. And with that, I will close the information session on House Bill 5028 and thank everyone from higher education that came here to help us out with this today, and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 155A. Ms. Jones.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, Ms. Jones comes up here. I may just let the committee know that last week you were informed that there would be work sessions tomorrow and on Thursday on the Department of Education operating budget, but we will not be holding those tomorrow and Thursday. It's taking a little more time to get that prepared for that work session. So we do not have meetings scheduled right now for you tomorrow.
Should we also put on the record that we got a letter from the carpenters in favor of the capital construction?
Excellent, yes. We did receive input from the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters, and this has become part of the permanent record of the proceedings.
Madam Chair, are we also going to be moving into a work session on Senate Bill 155? Is that your intent?
Okay. I don't think that this will take us an awful lot of time. It's pretty straightforward.
Thank you.
Ms. Jones.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 155A engrossed allows the Board of Psychologist Examiners to renew licenses other than on an annual basis, and it also would allow qualified technicians to administer the test and score the test. In front of you, I've given you the latest copy of the engrossed staff measure summary, as well as the testimony from the board today, and a copy of what was given to you yesterday, in case you forgot to bring them today.
Okay. We have a request also from Representative Barnhart, who is in Hearing Room A, who is not here. Representative Barnhart, we'd be very pleased to have you testify on this bill.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you for having me here this morning. For the record, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm State Representative from District 11. And as I understand it, we're on SB 155.
We are in public hearing right now.
Okay, good. SB 155 has two components. Original component proposed by the Board of Psychologist Examiners, which, as I understand it, essentially allows them to spread out the collection of ending their licensing year for the purpose of their bookkeeping and collections, which, as I see it, is simply a way of reducing the end-of-the-year rush and increasing their efficiency. I think it's pretty simple, an idea, and one that the committee certainly should support. The other idea is an amendment that was proposed in the Health Committee in the House. The purpose of this amendment was to clarify for the board that it is an appropriate activity of a psychologist to supervise psych technicians who provide routine testing services for the psychologist in the process of the psychologist's practice. Most other states have language similar to the language in our scope of practice law, and those other states interpret that scope of language to include the kind of supervisory role that I've described. Our board has somehow gotten the idea that the language in the statute does not include that function. The reality is that many tests that psychologists use are designed with the contemplation that they will actually be administered by a trained psych technician working under the supervision of a psychologist. Some tests, such as the Wechsler intelligence tests, and there's a series of them, actually have parts in their suggestions for administration at the beginning of the testing manual, in which they talk about the use of testing technicians. Many other tests, it is routine to use a testing technician to administer them because they're completely rote. There's no discretion. And it's simply something that has to be done by the steps in order to make certain that you have a valid administration of the test. Another reason, of course, for using testing technicians is that the cost decreases quite a bit as a result of doing that, because when you're doing a neuropsychological battery, for the purposes of understanding the way a person's is able to function in the world as a result of a head injury or a vascular accident or something of that sort, That examination involves many hours of testing, in addition, of course, to the interview with the psychologist and some tests which the psychologist will want to administer him or herself. The psychologist's role in that process is to integrate the testing data and information and reach a conclusion, often a diagnosis, about the person's difficulties and perhaps make recommendations for treatment or describe the person's capacity to function in the world and so forth, depending upon what the specific issue is that the referring agency or individual is interested in learning. But the psychologist doesn't have to personally administer all of those test instruments. The National Academy of Neuropsychologists and others have peer-reviewed journals which have published a large number of articles on the ethical and appropriate use of testing technicians in the process of neuropsychological practice. Now, it isn't simply neuropsychologists who use testing technicians. Many psychologists who do less extensive testing do as well. One of the most commonly used testing instruments in the area of personality, for example, is the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, and there's been several revisions since that name was first used. That's a true-false test, as it were, and can be administered by a testing technician with very little experience or knowledge of the test, so long as they follow guidelines that would be established by the psychologist. When I was in practice as a psychologist, I often had that test administered in the presence of my office secretary, to whom I had described what the requirements were and what the rules were, and whom I supervised directly in the sense that I was in the same building and was available in the event there were questions. And that's a perfectly reasonable way of administering that kind of test. Other tests require more training, and the psychologist under this bill would be required to make certain that the psych tech understands.
Representative Barnhart,
yes.
If I might interrupt. No, not to interrupt. I'll make my statement when he's finished.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Please proceed.
Well, I think maybe I've covered it. I think you also have been receiving information from various psychologists in favor of this bill. To my knowledge, there isn't any opposition to it. It's a way of getting the Board of Psychology Examiners out of a box of their own creation.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Barnhart, for your work on Senate Bill 155, and particularly the language in the amendment. I want to thank you for working with my constituent, Dr. David Gosnell. And just for the record, Madam Chair, the language in the amendment does state that the practice of psychology, this is line 28, 29, and 30 on page 3, the practice of psychology also includes delegating the administration and scoring of tests to technicians qualified by and under the direct supervision of a licensed psychologist. Again, I want to thank you for being so responsive to one of my constituents.
Thank you, Senator.
Further questions or comments for Representative Barnhart? Thank you very much for taking your time, and we'll let you get back to whatever it was you were doing in hearing room A.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Mann, do you wish to come forward and testify on the bill?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm here. My name is Kathy Mann, and I am still currently serving as the interim director for the Board of Psychologist Examiners. Thank you for providing me the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 155. I'll make this very quick and painless. The basic overview of what the bill would do is it changes our licensing renewal from annual to biannual, or maybe eventually birthday renewal. Currently, we have a 2.5 FTE staff and one person that does the licensing for a 2 to 3 month period beginning in November through January. Changing to a biennial licensing renewal rather than annual would reduce our licensing in half for this one FTE individual, who is me. This concept also would make sense for licensees because they would report their continuing education and renew their licenses all at the same time every other year. It would not be confusing for them as to, is this my year to report CE or when do I renew my license? It would make a lot more sense for them to simplify their licensing and also to lift the administrative burden on a very small staff. That is basically my testimony for today, and I welcome any questions.
The piece that allows the technicians to administer the test, does that add to the workload, to your workload?
Actually, no, it does not. It clarifies and defines something that has been very confusing for this board. It's going to be helpful. It will probably eliminate some of the trivial complaints that we have. And so this is actually a good amendment to this bill.
Questions or comments?
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. I would just add to your comments then, and this is looking at your written testimony, that it is your intent, the board's intent, to draft administrative rules further defining the use of testing assistance by its licensees.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 155 and open a work session on Senate Bill 155.
Oh my gosh,
do you have anything to add now that we're in work session?
No, Madam Chair, I do not.
Does anyone have anything they want to discuss now that we're in work session? The chair would accept a motion to move Senate Bill 155A to the Full Ways and Means Committee with a do-pass recommendation.
So moved.
Senator Gordley's made the motion. Is there a discussion on the motion? Objection to the motion?
No.
Without objection, the motion is carried. Senator Gordley, would you be so kind as to carry this in full and on the Senate floor?
I'd be happy to. Thank you.
And Representative Judy Smith, could I prevail upon you to carry this?
Madam Chair, I'd be honored. Thank you.
Okay. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 155A unless someone stops me right away. We have closed the work session. Is there any further business before the committee? I think we have our schedule laid out for the rest of the week, which is pretty easy. So I will adjourn this meeting, and we will reconvene at the call of the chair.
Okay.